From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Marlon Riggs' documentary, Tongues Untied, is an award-winning look at what it means to be a gay black man in America. It's also at the center of a broadcasting controversy. The documentary is being shown as part of Public Television's POV series, but some PBS stations are not carrying it, citing the film's strong language and imagery. On today's Fresh Air, we examine the controversy with the filmmaker, Marlon Riggs, and with executives from two of the stations that won't carry the program. Also today, we talk with the director of an oddball comedy called Slacker about people who have dropped out of society and sit around all day obsessing on their own thoughts. And Owen Gleiberman takes a fresh look at the first feature film from master director Martin Scorsese. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State James Baker and his Soviet counterpart, Alexander Besmertnik, have begun what they hope will be their last round of negotiations on the treaty limiting strategic nuclear weapons. NPR's Anne Garrels has this report.
Soviet Foreign Minister Besmertnik first called on President Bush at the White House and then went to the State Department to work on the last remaining issues that stand in the way of a START treaty. Secretary of State Baker said he hoped the two men could resolve the remaining problems so there can be a summit before the August break. But he said he could not predict if they would succeed. The main outstanding issue is how much information can be encoded and hidden from the other side during missile tests. Baker told senators this morning this issue has major verification consequences. And while keen to wrap up the treaty, Baker said he was not going to push it beyond what he thinks is responsible and prudent. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
House Democrats have elected Michigan Representative David Bonnier as the new majority whip. Bonnier defeated Steny Hoyer of Maryland by 160-109 in a secret ballot. He'll succeed retiring Representative William Gray as the number three member of the House Democratic leadership. The Turkish prime minister has appealed for calm in the wake of a deadly riot in the predominantly Kurdish city of Diyarbakir. From Cizre, NPR's Deborah Wong reports.
The troubles began yesterday when an estimated 30,000 people gathered for the funeral of a slain Kurdish politician. According to eyewitnesses and reporters on the scene, crowds of mourners began throwing stones at two police stations. Turkish police responded by firing into the crowds, killing three people and injuring more than 100. Today, a government spokesperson blamed the incident on provocateurs. She said the police fired upon the crowds only after shots were fired first at police. The Turkish Prime Minister, Mesut Yılmaz, appealed for calm in the city, and he condemned what he called the groundless accusations against state forces. Many shops remain closed in the city today as residents continue to mourn the slain Kurdish politician Vedat Aydin. He was found murdered earlier this week after reportedly being abducted by police. I'm Deborah Wong reporting.
Military sources said today that the Pentagon is preparing to announce the details of the rapid deployment force that will protect the Kurds in northern Iraq. The sources, who asked not to be identified, said that U.S. troops will make up one-third of the force, which will be based in Turkey. Other components of the force will come from France, Britain, Italy, the Netherlands, and Spain. The force is expected to number about 15,000 troops, including its backup air power. Final agreement on the makeup of the force is expected to clear the way for the withdrawal of the remaining 1,400 U.S. troops in northern Iraq. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained almost 15 points to close at 2,959. This is NPR. The American Civil Liberties Union is trying to reopen a 1989 criminal case that was killed by the CIA. The private group is suing the Iran-Contra prosecutor in an effort to obtain classified documents about the case. The Iran-Contra prosecutor accused former CIA station chief Joseph Fernandez of covering up his knowledge of the scandal. The case was never tried because the CIA succeeded in getting certain classified material banned from use in court. The ACLU now says that the special prosecutor should hand over that material so that the case can be pursued. President Bush and Japanese Prime Minister Toshiki Kaifu emerged from their meeting today praising relations between their countries. The two leaders are at the president's vacation home in Kennebunkport. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Broadcasting reports.
President and Prime Minister downplayed individual differences between the two countries on issues such as trade and Japan's financial contribution to the Gulf War.
Where there are differences, they are outweighed by the common ground that we share and the common objectives that we share.
The two leaders also stressed what they said was a common approach on the question of aid to the Soviet economy. Western economic leaders will discuss the issue next week in London, with Japan being the most reluctant to give financial aid to the Soviets. Mr. Bush received a long letter today from Soviet President Gorbachev on economic issues. The president said he gave a copy of it to Mr. Kaifu. Mr. Bush refused to comment on its contents, saying it was still being analyzed. Prime Minister Kaifu is scheduled to spend the night in Kennebunkport. The president also announced today he's agreed to visit Japan sometime in late November. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
Japanese finance officials said today that Japan's trade surplus with other nations grew in June for the sixth consecutive month. That growth came at the expense of Europe and Asia. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next week, the PBS series POV will feature a documentary about what it's like to be a black homosexual, marginalized by African-American activists who are uncomfortable with their homosexuality, and gay activists who don't relate to your blackness. The documentary is called Tongues Untied. The title refers to finding the courage to speak the truth about who you are. And the truth, as it is told by filmmaker Marlon Riggs, includes nudity, scenes of men kissing, profanity, and the racial and sexual slurs which he's been subjected to. Because of the imagery and the language, about 18 stations in the top 50 markets have decided not to run this film. Coming up, we're going to talk to station representatives about making this decision, and we'll hear from the filmmaker Marlon Riggs. First, to give you a sense of what we're talking about, I want to play you a clip from the film. And here's where this story about art and broadcasting gets tricky for us. We want you to hear how Riggs is using language in Tongues Untied, and yet we've decided to bleep out the profanity. A difficult decision that has its absurd dimensions, but the fact is that the FCC and most stations that broadcast Fresh Air have different daytime and nighttime standards regulating what is called indecency, and on most stations we are a daytime show where the standards are stricter. This excerpt of Tongues Untied features the filmmaker Marlon Riggs telling some of his own story.
At age 11, we moved to Georgia. I graduated to new knowledge.
Homo.
You don't know how to kiss?
Homo.
My best friend asked, shocked. I didn't know what to do with a girl when I lost I'd spend the bottle.
Homo.
I'll show you, he said, his brown eyes inviting. We practiced kissing for weeks, dry, wet, French, till his older brother called us a name.
Homo.
What's a homo? I asked.
Punk, faggot, freak.
I understood. We stopped kissing. Best friend became worst enemy.
Motherfucking coon.
Age 12, they bussed me to Hepzibah Junior High on the outskirts of Augusta.
Motherfucking coon.
A spray-painted sign on the wall greeted me.
Niggas, go home.
The rednecks hated me.
Motherfucking coon.
Because I was one of only two blacks placed in 8A, the class for Hepzibah's best and brightest.
Niggas, go home.
The blacks hated me.
Uncle Tome.
Because they assumed my class status made me uppity.
Uncle Tome.
Assumed my silence as superiority.
An excerpt of Tongues Untied, an experimental documentary that mixes monologues, poetry, music, and dance. To find out about how PBS made the decision to schedule this controversial program, we called Jennifer Lawson, the head of programming at PBS. I asked if she was concerned about the program violating standards of indecency and obscenity.
We've had our own legal counsel review the program, and that it's our assessment that the program will not and does not violate those standards. And that certainly was a consideration that we made in the offering of it to our stations. This language is not the first time that it has been presented on public television or on broadcast television. I think what makes Tongues Untied more of a focus in respect to the language there is the presentation in the context of a program that deals with issues of sexuality.
Now, is that what program directors who aren't carrying the show are telling you, or is that just deducing?
Program directors who are not carrying the show are making a determination based upon the appropriateness of the material of this program and the way in which their stations are viewed on a local level. Many of our public television stations present themselves in their communities as family channels and make the promise to the community that the material that's being offered is appropriate for family viewing. This is a program where, by its very nature, we have there is a viewer advisory, which suggests that some of the material, that the subject matter and the language that's used in the programming is not necessarily appropriate for viewing by younger children. And so it's entirely reasonable that stations would elect not to carry the program at all.
So you're not disturbed that some stations aren't carrying it. You just accept that there's going to be different approaches, different editorial standards in different parts of the country.
Very definitely, very definitely. And that is something that I think that is that we certainly respect, and that we have, that it's that's a much better approach than PBS as a national service deciding not to carry and not make the program available for any communities.
Let me ask you, we're in a time now where there have been a lot of challenges from especially the religious conservative groups, challenges against sexually explicit or homosexual art. And you're running this show in that climate. Are you worried at all about losing funders or losing listener support because of the broadcast?
We certainly cannot ignore the fact that for many people in this country, any issues around sexuality, and particularly homosexuality, being raised in a public context are considered offensive, considered in bad judgment. And that's something that we will, you know, we certainly take into consideration. On the other hand, we feel that it is part of our responsibility as public service broadcasters to provide to our viewers as full an overview of the reality of the circumstances of people in our country, and that the issues, the people presented in this film, the reality of people who are who face in their lives both the experience of being Black or Asian American and gay, and the complexity of that, is a story that should be told. And that's part of what we see as the alternative role of public television, to present those stories that are not told. And in doing so, one does risk controversy. One does risk a lack of support.
Jennifer Lawson is head of programming at PBS. Jesse Bowers is vice president for programming at the South Carolina Educational TV Network. He decided not to broadcast Tongues Untied.
After viewing the program and looking at the content, both language and some nudity, we felt that it just did not meet our community standards. We took a very in-depth look at it, and for those reasons, just decided that we could not air this program.
One of the thorny parts of community standards, looking at it historically, is, for instance, during the Civil Rights Movement, there were stations in the South that wanted to pull the plug on the network news when the network news was showing civil rights demonstrations. Community standards can sometimes be against free speech and be against showing things that oppose their political views or oppose their sensibility. So can you talk to me a little bit about trying to figure out, like, where to draw the line within community standards?
I think you're right when you say that community standards can oppose political views or political ideologies. And I think that's where the real fine line is in terms of not bowing to community pressures, but when clearly it is a matter of language and nudity, I don't think that there's a comparison there. I think that it's clearly defined that certain four-letter words are just not acceptable.
WTVS in Detroit is another station that won't be showing Tongues Untied. Bob Larson is the president and general manager of the station. He said their decision was based on the program's imagery and language. I asked if it was the four-letter words.
No, not necessarily four-letter type words. We're talking about the words that were explicit, graphically explicit in their description of sexual activity. and it was unremitting in many ways. So our issue was not with the subject of the program, nor with the fact that we feel that it, in many ways it's a powerful program. Our decision was based upon the acceptability or the suitability of language for over-the-air television.
Now, what were the images that you found objectionable?
It was a combination of the images and the words themselves. I think to select any one image is not fair to the program. In fact, I would not even dream of asking Mr. Riggs to change the program because I think it has its own kind of integrity. It's a compelling kind of experimental documentary.
Is your concern about the FCC and FCC regulations about language, or is it more just the standards of your viewers?
No, it's the standards of ourselves as programmers. It's not the standard of our viewers. It's the standards that we're trying to protect as a station in what we offer to our viewers. It is a quality judgment. It is indeed a value judgment. It's the kind of a judgment that an editor makes every day in terms of should he print this piece or not print the piece. And we have made that judgment saying that it is not something that we want on the front page of our air magazine, if you will. That doesn't necessarily condemn program because there are other outlets for the program. There are museums, as you know, or theaters, or even paid television. But this is an open airwave, and we come as uninvited or invited guests into the homes of our viewers, and I think that responsibility really guided us in this decision.
Of course, viewers have channel selectors and on and off switches.
That's true. They do. But they also have an expectation that we have created over the years in terms of the quality that they can expect, the fairness, the objectivity, and the taste. And so this was that issue.
You know, public broadcasters and radio and TV are in a kind of unique situation in that the listeners and the viewers are also the funders. And I think there's always an awareness that viewers who are very alienated, one of the first things they do is they write you a letter saying, "I'll never pledge again." Does that kind of stuff enter into your programming decisions at all, or is that something you try to not think about?
I think we try to avoid that. I think to make the question based upon the fact that we're going to be accused of censorship in this issue, for example, or that we're going to lose viewers if we do air it, we really tried to keep both of those components out of our mind as we looked at the program itself. And we have to look at it and say, does it have inherent value? And we said, yes, it has inherent value. Is there anything that keeps us from airing it? Yes, the language unfortunately kept us from airing it. But please don't categorize or stereotype those who say no as being in some way homophobic or in some way opposed to controversy. That's a mistake also. This is an independent programming decision.
We'll speak with the director of Tongues Untied after this short break. This is Fresh Air. The film that we've been discussing, Tongues Untied, is a very personal film for the director, Marlon Riggs. He is on camera discussing his experiences as a gay black man. Riggs won an Emmy for his earlier documentary, Ethnic Notions, about black stereotypes. Riggs didn't make Tongues Untied for TV. He was surprised and pleased when PBS picked it up. He thinks many broadcasters have a hypocritical double standard when it comes to determining what is obscene and indecent.
When you show, in this case, two men tenderly kissing, or you deal with a language of rage in which people who have been suppressed, bottled up, denied any humanity, denied a space in society, finally learning to speak, and speaking with the anger of their emotion about that the feeling of having been suppressed and denied a place for so long, then for some reason that is termed as obscene, an affront, confrontational, and therefore unworthy of being put on television.
If you were approached by television to do a documentary on a similar subject or on the same subject. Do you think you'd make a different kind of film knowing that that it would be broadcast? I mean, I'm thinking even a lot of feature films, there's kind of like two versions made at the same time, one with language for the theaters and one with language for TV.
No, I would not do that, because that gets to the basic point of what public television, I think, should be about. Either you can make television, you can make work that, in fact, is designed really to reassure the status quo, to play into the myths of who audiences think they are and who they think we as the subjects of our work are, and that in no way really challenges us to rethink all of the terms and all of the frameworks by which we define ourselves and others. Or you can make work which, in fact, does that, that it does challenge, that it does stimulate, that it provokes. And what I chose to do and was very clear about doing with this work was reflecting the truth of my experience as a Black gay man, not to compromise it, not to situate it in a way so that all I was begging for, which is the kind of programming that typically the broadcasters love to have, begging for sympathy and tolerance and understanding, but rather a program that would affirm the totality of the struggles that I have faced as a Black gay man and that my community faces as Black gay men.
Tongues Untied is about in part the double marginalization of being Black and being homosexual and not being too well accepted in either community. When you came out in the movie, you talk about the absence of Black gay images in the books and in the posters and even in your own fantasies. What effect did that lack, that absence of Black images have on you?
That effect was one of making me feel extremely isolated, as if I was the only one in the world, that made me feel that I myself was unworthy of love, that I had nothing that I could offer, because in gay society, there was nothing that affirmed who I was as a Black man. That is, in gay society, all of the icons of beauty, of excellence, of virtue were white. And of course, in Black American society, I had no icons that I could look up to, and that everyone worthy of emulation within the Black community was resolutely heterosexual, according to the myth. So that for someone who was Black and gay and looking for some form of affirmation in larger social life for who they were, who I am, there was nothing there.
You know, in talking about how white you found the gay community to be after you came out, I'm wondering if occasionally the opposite wasn't true, and I'm thinking that for a lot of politicized social movements, there's this almost fear of being perceived as a white middle-class movement, and I think for some of the movements, and I'd include in this the feminist movement, that for Blacks who enter the movement, they're so welcome because it's a sign of what people want to be true, that it's not just a white movement.
But no, but what happens that even when one is welcome, one is welcome as a Black person, whether one is a Black female feminist or a Black gay man, when you are welcome into that larger white society, you're welcomed on the terms of that society, not on your own terms.
And how are those two terms different for you? Yeah.
So, for instance, I can go into the Castro to a certain degree if I'm willing to play by the game and dress in the way that white gay men dress, read the books that white gay men read, not discuss issues of race, not bring those kinds of issues up, not discuss the issues and problems of the African-American community when I talk about liberation. If I am willing to subscribe to these narrow notions of liberation that just address sexuality, and if I'm willing to abide by these roles that many white gay men see me as, and that is this super sex stud with not much intelligence that's really worth addressing or reckoning with, then I will be welcome. I will be accepted. I think that many Black gay men have found in moving into white gay societies and trying to assimilate is that when they bring their issues and experiences to bear in addressing how that society should be constructed, how it should move and develop, that when they do so, they encounter tremendous resistance, because what they also illuminate in those white gay societies is a racism that pervades that world as much as it pervades the straight world.
Now, you felt, as you stated in the movie, that there's also been a lot of trouble for black homosexuals like yourself to get acceptance within black political movements.
Yes, within black society at large, not just politics.
What kinds of places have you been made to feel unwelcome as a man who is out and who sees homosexuality as a political and social issue? Do you know what I mean? I mean, the right to be who you are as being a political social issue.
I mean, there's so many areas of life, but personally, I think because of the nature of my work, which is cultural, I'm a documentary maker.
Yeah.
And of course, you constantly hear within black society, within African-American society and communities, about the need for so-called positive images, the need to redress the wrongs of historic omission in the media culture and the popular culture of America. So that when I start to treat those kinds of issues, as long as I present images that affirm a heterosexist point of view, that is, in which all of the so-called role models are wonderful black family in the most traditional sense, heterosexual people, then I am fine. The moment that I try to introduce issues of sexual difference into that equation, then I'm suddenly betraying the need for positive images and presenting, in fact, the opposite. And so that when I try to bring to bear the full dimension of my own personality, my own identity, and the communities that I know, that world is seen as somehow pariah and mutually exclusive to this world of black society, which often the black straight middle class would prefer to see.
You say that in some areas you'd get a question like, well, what are you first? Are you black or are you gay? Give me an example of the kind of situation where you've been asked a question like that.
I mean, I think so many of us, you know, particularly when we come out visibly, we're challenged on that level. And many black feminists were challenged on that level in the 70s and still are. It's a situation, particularly among so-called Afrocentric revolutionary types, and obviously I'm being tongue-in-cheek here, who demand of you to know, well, when the revolution comes, you know, or when society has to really choose which battles it's going to fight first, who will you align yourself with? Will you be a black person first, or will you be gay, and will you align yourself with the gay people? And often the assumption is that the gay people are pretty much exclusively white. And what I try to do in my work is subvert that, because what that requires is a level of schizophrenia. It's a level of being able to and trying to hierarchize oneself into these component parts in which you can say, well, I guess I'm black first, and then maybe I'm gay second, and then maybe I'm a man third, and then maybe I'm a person of color, and then maybe I'm a working class. No. The personality of any human being is indivisible. All of that which makes you, and it's integral to you.
One of the things you reveal about yourself in the movie is that you've tested HIV positive. Did you know that when you started the movie, or is that something
Yes.
you found out as you were making it?
No, I knew that before starting it. In fact, it was a major catalyst to my making this movie, and to making it uncompromising and searing and honest in the language and the so-called graphic depictions of our imagery, and also in the quite honest and brutal analysis of racism and homophobia and self-hatred. And I mean self-hatred on the part of black gay men themselves in our society.
Marlon Riggs, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marlon Riggs' documentary, Tongues Untied, will be shown on many PBS stations next Tuesday night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The dictionary calls a slacker a person who evades their duty or work. Richard Linklater called his new film Slacker. It's a funny look at some quirky people who are underachievers and proud of it. And before Mean Streets and Taxi Driver, Martin Scorsese made a movie called Who's That Knocking at My Door? Critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the home video release of Scorsese's first feature film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At the UN, a committee overseeing the trade embargo against Iraq has refused to consider a request that Baghdad be allowed to sell oil to buy humanitarian goods. NPR's Jim Zarroli reports from New York.
Yesterday, Iraq asked the UN Security Council's Sanctions Committee for permission to sell $1.5 billion worth of oil. It said it wanted to buy food, medicine, and farm equipment. Iraq said the continuing trade sanctions are creating a human catastrophe inside the country. Today, the committee met, but as expected, refused to consider the Iraqi request. Officials said they must first hear back from the UN team currently investigating humanitarian conditions in southern Iraq. But the Iraqi request is unlikely to be approved even after the mission returns. The U.S. and its allies believe Iraq has plenty of foreign currency reserves with which to buy food if it wants to, but is deliberately concealing what it has. This is the second time Iraq has asked permission to sell oil without success. In New York, this is Jim Zarroli reporting.
Allied forces are expected to announce sometime tomorrow that a quick strike force of almost 3,000 troops will be stationed in Turkey as a precaution against any moves Iraqi President Saddam Hussein might take to harm Kurds in Iraq. Included in this armed force will be troops from the United States, Britain, France, Italy, Turkey, Spain, Belgium, and the Netherlands. One U.S. military official is quoted as saying, "It's just a matter of working out final details." Mexico City, with a population of some 20 million people, literally shut down for nearly 7 minutes today, as just about everyone stopped to watch a solar eclipse. Sandina Robbins has this report from Mexico City.
Everyone became a sun worshiper today as people kneeled down in the heart of Mexico City, El Zócalo, alongside the Aztec ruins. With arms outstretched, young and old opened their hands to the sky to receive the sun's energy. Colorfully dressed Aztec-style musicians and dancers recreated a pre-Hispanic atmosphere with the sounds of their drums, rattles, and the haunting horn sound of the conch shells. Traffic spontaneously stopped as the sky turned dark and the moon passed between the earth and sun. The total eclipse lasted nearly 7 minutes, yet the feeling of a peaceful calm continued to reign over the normally hectic downtown. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandina Robbins in Mexico City.
The government says that new claims for unemployment benefits fell by 35,000 for the week ending June 29th. The Labor Department says weekly claims are now at 388,000. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 15 points in moderate trading. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the Congressional Black Caucus says that it will vigorously oppose the nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court of Judge Clarence Thomas. The caucus declined to give its reason for its opposition to Thomas, who is black, but it indicated that it was based partly on his record as head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Thomas has been accused by critics of lax enforcement of anti-discrimination laws as head of EEOC during the Reagan administration. Senate GOP leader Robert Dole held a news conference today to denounce those who support revoking most favored nation trade status for China. But the news conference was attended by Chinese students who argued that the U.S. should use trade as leverage to force human rights improvements. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more.
a day after the House passed extension of the trade status with a lengthy list of conditions attached, Minority Leader Bob Dole launched his campaign to defeat the measure in the Senate. Dole brought with him several Chinese students who said suspending most favored nation trade status with China or hinging it on human rights improvements would ultimately hurt Chinese peasants and have little effect on Chinese leadership. One woman said most Chinese students had no interest in punishing the government through trade.
I think the majority of the Chinese students are supporting our position, but unfortunately they are quiet.
But the Chinese students that packed the press conference weren't quiet, and they brought letters and petitions from hundreds of other students who argued that Chinese people suffer more from repression than from poverty. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Also in Capitol Hill, House Democrats have elected David Bonnier of Michigan as new majority whip. Bonnier defeated Congressman Steny Hoyer 160-109 in a secret ballot to replace Congressman William Gray, who is retiring from Congress. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Maybe you know what it's like to be in your 20s and drop out of college or drop out of society altogether because you don't want to do what you've been programmed to do, and you get really caught up in your own inner world. Slacker is a movie about that state of mind. It's a super low-budget, oddball comedy that played the festival circuit for a year and did so well it's now opening in movie theaters. My guest is the director, Richard Linklater. He lives near the university in Austin, Texas, where he shot the film. He cast the film with friends, rock musicians, street people, and strangers he approached because they looked right for the part. Linklater got obsessed with movies after he dropped out of college. A couple of years later, he founded a film society in Austin so he could screen the movies that he most wanted to see. Slacker is the 28-year-old director's second film. What is a slacker?
That's always the big question. Well, it's in the dictionary. I mean, by definition, I think it means someone who evades duties or responsibilities. But to me, it means someone who's kind of ultimately being responsible to themselves, you know, and taking time to, you know, discover what it is they really should be doing in their life instead of what they've been programmed to do.
Now, in the opening scene of Slacker, you're the actor, and you're taking a cab from the bus station to a place that I presume is your home. And in the cab, you're going into this long rap about dreams and the relative nature of reality. Let me play a clip from that.
I just had the weirdest dream. Back on the bus there? Do you ever have those dreams that are just completely real? I mean, they're so vivid. It's just, like, completely real. Man, there was this book I just read on the bus. Well, you know, it was my dream, so I guess I wrote it or something. But, man, it was bizarre. It was like the premise for this whole book was that every thought you have creates its own reality. You know, it's like every choice or decision you make, the thing you choose not to do fractions off and becomes its own reality, you know, and just goes on from there forever. I mean, it's like back there at the bus station, you know, as I got off the bus, the thought crossed my mind, you know, just for a second about not taking a cab at all, but, you know, maybe walking or bumming a ride or something like that. You know, I'm kind of broke right now. I should have done that probably. But just because that thought crossed my mind, there now exists at this very second a whole nother reality where I'm at the bus station, you know, and you're probably giving someone else a ride, you know? I mean, in that reality, thinks of itself as this, it thinks of itself as the only reality, you know? I mean, at this very second, I'm in that, I'm back.
Where does this rap come from? Is this one of your raps, or is this a rap that you've heard?
Yeah, no, I just totally wrote it at my word processor.
Is it a rap? Is it a rap you believe in? Is it yours?
It's kind of in the air. There's some, I think, even some physical evidence, certain like new physics stuff kind of suggests that this is a possibility. And then I think along certain, you know, there's been books that kind of hint at this. You know. So I basically believe it on one level.
And on another level?
You know, I mean, it's like most of the raps in the movie. I mean, it can be complete, you know, crap, or, you know, you can believe it. I choose to believe things. Just it's kind of a more interesting way to go through life, you know.
Now, there's really virtually no conversation in this movie. It's all a series of raps and monologues from people who are either incredibly self-absorbed or slightly out of their minds. I wonder where all these monologues, maybe, right? I wonder where all these monologues are from. Do people like that kind of gravitate to you? Do you transcribe what they have to say? Mm-hmm. Or is this just stuff that you came up with to give to other characters?
Well, I saw the entire movie as one monologue with like 100 voices or however many people really speak. And in each individual segment, it's kind of like a one-sided monologue with someone listening and then someone doing all the talking and obsessed, you know. Or I saw the movie as kind of an interior monologue, the crazy thoughts that go on in our minds all the time, just as we walk in just these kind of, I don't know, our passing thoughts. And I thought it'd be very interesting to bring that interior, that interior monologue forth in a social way. So it all seems like an attempt at communication, but it's kind of a noble attempt. It was kind of some ideal world that if people really could try to communicate, even though they're obviously not always connecting or conveying their thoughts properly, or whatever their obsessions are, I thought it would be interesting to watch people trying to communicate what's on their mind.
You're making it sound so serious. To me, it's a comedy.
Yeah, it's definitely a comedy.
Okay.
I mean, because I think a lot of the raps that are in people's minds are pretty funny.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me play a rap I especially enjoy. This is one of your conspiracy theory types. This is a guy who thinks that we got anti-gravity technology from the Nazis after World War II. We've already been to Mars, but there's been a big cover-up about it.
You know about the suppressed transmission, of course. No? Ah, well. This is the 20th anniversary of the moonwalk, you know, and way back there when they given us that one giant step for mankind bit. Oh, yeah. Another astronaut's in the background yelling his fool head off, saying, oh, my God, what's that over in the crater? What the hell is that? Well, NASA cuts him off just like that. But those of us with the right kind of radios, you know what I mean? Yeah, we got enough of it. The gist of it with that is a giant spacecraft over in the other crater. Looking at them. That's right. I was watching this Late Late Show. A lot of truth in the Late Late Show. You know, they slip it through there. They figure nobody's watching. But anyway, it's a sci-fi movie called Alternative 3. And it's about kidnapping people, using a little psychosurgery on them, you know, and turn them into zombies and making them colonize the moon and Mars. Funny, huh? Except it's absolutely true. All of it.
Okay, so where did this monologue come from? Did you sit down and dream this one up, or is this the kind of thing you hear floating around?
Yeah, like every scene, a lot of the information, you know, some I wrote, some I have friends with specialized knowledge, and, you know, some little things I overheard. But kind of like every scene has its own history. On the UFO walk, a lot of that, I thought of that situation. I thought it'd be very funny if someone followed someone out and, you know, accosted them and laid this rap on them based on something he just overheard in a previous conversation. A friend of theirs is they haven't seen lately. So that triggers in his mind the whole missing person thing and how that, you know, connects all these other thoughts. But for a lot of that information, I went to a friend of mine who initially I wanted to play the part. He's up on all the latest conspiracy stuff and, you know, very thorough about it. You know, I'm a minor league conspiracy person, but he's definitely major league. So I just met with him. He didn't want to play the part. He refused to be photographed, of course. So I cast someone who I thought looked the part, and actually the guy who plays that character had come into a video audition. I thought he looked the part immediately. And then, sure enough, in the video audition, he had some sightings, and he told me about some of that. So I thought he was the perfect guy. And but a lot of that information came from, this friend of mine. I just sat and took notes and then worked it into a script form, and then with the actor, we, you know, rehearsed endlessly, which I'd say that's similar to a lot of the scenes in the movie. I would come up with a script, and then with the actors, we would sit there with pen in hand at a table for hours or however long it took, days, and just work up whatever seemed to be working for that scene. And the actors were always free to, you know, rewrite or throw in ideas. I mean, a lot of the movie hinged on their own, you know, creative, you know, abilities.
Now, when you say that you're up on conspiracy theories, what do we mean by that?
Up on conspiracy? Oh, maybe it's just a state of mind that you see conspiracies out there. You can look at a lot of society as a conspiracy, whether conscious or unconscious. So,
my guest is Richard Linklater, the director of the new independent film Slacker. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Film director Richard Linklater is my guest. How did you start getting interested in the offbeat obsessions that people have and the way they talk about them to other people?
I don't know. I think it's just the world I lived in, just this whole slacker environment where no one either has the means or the energy or just hasn't got it together. I think it's just being in your 20s and out of college that it's hard to really get a lot of things going. So inevitably, you just kind of sit around and talk about it. So I always knew there was a movie there, people just talking obsessively about what's going on, their particular understanding of something or what they would like to do or be doing or not being able to do.
Which is the rap that you consider closest to who you are?
Oh, I think I might have a few people would say the character who sits in his room and doesn't really want to leave the 1 square mile radius that he lives in and is content to kind of not go anywhere or do anything.
I said it's nice outside. We should go do something.
Like what?
Well, you know, there's a lake in this town. We could go out there. We could go out to the hills. We could go to the park and play frisbee.
I hate that. All that nature. And the sunlight's so oppressive now. And you don't just go to the lake. You have to prepare for it. You have to get suntan lotion and insecticide. It's that premeditated fun.
On one level, that could be me, but I wouldn't be sitting there reading the newspaper, watching television. I'd be like reading or working on films or watching a movie or something like that. But, I mean, I lived in Austin for 7 years before I went to a lake that's 3 miles out of town.
Hey, no one can accuse you of not getting around.
That's right.
Do you think of yourself as a slacker? I mean,
Yeah, I think so. Just because by one definition of like not having anything to show for all your labor, which society quickly labels, and that's what slacker really means. It's kind of this social accusation, like you're lazy, you're a slacker, you're not pulling your weight, you know, in this society, which means you're not doing anything that can be, that's a commodity that can be sold or someone can make money off of. I mean, you can't really put a price on ideas or energies that people are spending out, you know, engaged in outside the marketplace. So I spent years, you know, 8 years involved with film. I mean, I knew what I wanted to do rather early on, so I guess I'm lucky in that way. But for all those years, I didn't have anything to show for it. I wasn't employed. I wasn't making money at what I was doing, spending all my time doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's some rough years. You have to kind of put up with the wrath of society thinking you're lazy when I was, in actuality, spending every waking second of almost every day involved in what I wanted to do. So, but it's just only now that I have something to show for it.
Let's talk about you a little bit. You dropped out of college as a sophomore?
Yeah, I went 2 years.
Why'd you leave?
Actually, because I got, this sounds funny, but I got a good summer job. I was working on an oil rig. And really, at that point in my life, school just kind of seemed like a drag. Even though I always did pretty well in school, I don't know, all I really wanted to do at that time was read. So I had a job where I could read about, you know, 12 to 15 hours a day. So I just did that. I kind of didn't want to be involved. I don't know, went through kind of a necessary isolated period. I was out in the Gulf of Mexico working on a rig and just away from everything. I kind of retired from society for about 18 months. But it was through that period I was just reading. And when I was on land, I started going to movies. So that's really where I discovered movies. My shift focused from like literature and writing and drama to movies.
So when did you feel ready to return to land and return to society?
Never. let's see. I mean, I did that for almost 2 years and then I moved to Austin. I'd saved up money. I mean, that was I don't know, that's kind of the great thing about this society. It's not mandatory work. If you can figure out your own thing, I stayed out there. I made a lot of money and I just saved it up and I basically didn't have to work for a long time and I got to spend all my time doing my own thing, which was going to movies, reading and, you know, working on movies. I at that point bought a camera and started, you know, teaching myself filmmaking.
Because you're in your 20s and because your movie is about a certain sensibility, a certain way of seeing the world, you're being seen as, in a way, as the voice of the younger generation, you know, the voice of the generation that came after the baby boom generation, the 20-something generation. Oh, yes.
No. Yes.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I'll say I'm one of millions of voices who of a generation that doesn't want to be summed up easily or categorized. So
mm-hmm.
Any kind of spokesman role feels pretty uncomfortable, just because I know I don't like anyone speaking for my generation, so I doubt they do either.
Have there been things that really bothered you about growing up after the baby boom generation, a generation that really thinks in a lot of ways and invented a lot of things?
Yeah, it's a little tough. I think growing up knowing, oh, you know, they're talking about how radical and cool it all was and how we're a bunch of, you know, complacent do-nothings. Yeah, you grow up with that. The 60s were so cool and hip and everything, and then we're kind of stuck with nothing. I was really conscious of that growing up, and even, you know, in the 70s going, oh, this is a nothing decade. God, I wish I would have grown up in the 60s. And it's that kind of thinking that's why, you know, oldies radio, that I think we'll be listening to those same 400 songs until, you know, we're in our, you know, just forever, because they've kind of got a lock on it and there's more of them than us.
So in a way, your movie's this, like, wry comment on the generation that's been called the nothing generation, or seen as it.
Yeah, but it's not nothing at all. It's just we've been kind of forced underground by this sort of, you know, baby boomer, yuppie hegemony, basically. You know, everything we're doing doesn't have the same marketplace that the stuff they love, you know. And they're less willing to kind of see what's going on now. You know, it'll never be as good as what they did. So I think it's almost a natural, you know, as you get older, I mean, to think that your time was the best, but I don't know, it's nostalgic and unproductive. You got to move forward.
Richard Linklater's new film Slacker is now showing in New York and Austin. It's scheduled to open in Los Angeles next week and in other cities throughout the summer. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, we're going to lead the show with the eclipse. We knew it was going to happen, so it's not exactly news, but somehow it was an incredible event, a magnificent event. We sat on the phone with several groups of people in Hawaii, and they described for us exactly what happened. And you'll hear what they said. We're going to play you the 5 minutes of real-time tape from 30 seconds before darkness to the full totality of the eclipse in Hawaii, and then the 30 seconds afterwards. It's quite something. We also have a report on Alaska and drilling in the Arctic Preserve. That's later tonight on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
The movies Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and Goodfellas have made Martin Scorsese one of America's most important film directors. Few people have seen his first feature film, Who's That Knocking at My Door, which he made in 1968 when he was 26. But now you can see it on home video. Owen Gleiberman has a review.
It's always fascinating to see the early, low-budget works of a filmmaker who has since gone on to greatness. Often, these shoestring efforts reveal the first stirrings of a director's celebrated style, as well as the themes and obsessions that would drive his later work. So it's no big surprise that Martin Scorsese's Who's That Knocking at My Door plays as a kind of sketchbook for his 1973 masterpiece, Mean Streets. The surprise is that Scorsese's mastery was already evident. The movie stars Harvey Keitel as J.R., a younger version of Charlie, the tormented Italian-American numbers runner Keitel played in Mean Streets. J.R. isn't really a crook. He's just a neighborhood joker with a Bobby Darin hairdo who gets off on acting tough. Like Charlie, though, he's torn between identities. He spends most of his time joshing around with the guys in Little Italy, but he also finds himself falling for the sweet, doting young woman he picks up on the Staten Island ferry. In the film's credits, she's referred to simply as the girl, and that's a telling detail. Here, as in Mean Streets, Scorsese looks at a guilt-ridden Catholic who can't quite envision his girlfriend as a whole person. He likes talking to her about his favorite John Wayne movies, but he's so obsessed with sin that he can barely make love to her. When J.R. learns that his new sweetheart was once raped, to him, it spoils her purity.
Listen, I told you that I loved you. Now, what's wrong with that? Isn't that enough?
Nothing's wrong with that, but no, it's not enough.
Well, why isn't that enough?
It's not good enough.
Not good enough?
No.
Well, not good enough. Oh, you mean I'm not good enough, is that it? Well, let me tell you something. It's not me, it's you. Who do you think you are, the Virgin Mary or something? Leading me on like that, letting me in here at this hour of the morning, huh? Well, come off it, will you? What are you handing me? What kind of brother does that make you, huh? And tell me something else while you're at it. Who else is going to marry you while you're at it, huh? Tell me that while you're at it, you whore. Because that's what you are if you don't know it by now, you whore.
Who's That Knocking at My Door was made when Scorsese was barely out of NYU film school. Yet it's clear from this early autobiographical work that his technical brilliance has always been matched by his ability to direct the camera at his characters' souls. His hypnotic, almost musical editing and experimental use of sound aren't just gimmicks. They're attempts to create a dual layer of consciousness, an awareness of what's going on both inside and outside J.R.'s mind. In this one feature, we can see how Scorsese Americanized the documentary rawness of Jean-Luc Godard, making it move to a rock and roll beat. Already, he was unparalleled when it came to using pop music as an ecstatic counterpart to violence and emotional turbulence. Who's That Knocking features an amazingly erotic montage set to the Doors song, The End. There are also several up-tempo sequences as exhilarating as anything in Mean Streets or Goodfellas. Perhaps the most revealing of these features the hard-driving title song played over swirlingly seductive shots of holy statues inside a church. Who's That Knocking at My Door is finally about sex, rock and roll, and the Catholic passion for transcendence. In Martin Scorsese's movies, that's the real Holy Trinity.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. We'd love to hear your comments about Fresh Air, and we have a new toll-free number for you to call to tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-NPR-WHYY. So let us know what you like and what you don't. The number is 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's been nearly 5 years since we learned about the Iran-Contra affair. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Tim Weiner talks with us about some of the latest developments in the scandal. And industrial designer Peter Bressler tells us about the search for the perfect urban trash can. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.